You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got one on responsive design techniques for you, different ways that you can approach making a website responsive. It's a pretty good one. It's not just your mobile first and desktop first. There's a lot more to it. We are sponsored by three awesome companies: Linode, Cloud Computing, LogRocket, JavaScript Session Replay, and FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. My name is Wes Boss, a developer from Canada. With me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Hey, I'm doing good. Just, man, we did a crazy clean of our house.
This weekend?
This Saturday. Yeah, we had some, you know, play date with this some of Landon's kindergarten friends. And oh, so yeah. It was like,
our can't house let them know like how you live.
Hot mess. Yeah, totally. And so we were like, let's just whirlwind it, like go as fast as possible. And let me tell you, man, it was the clean of a lifetime. And now our house, it feels so nice. Because I was like all day on Sunday, we were just like, oh, we don't really have to do very much today. We can like focus on detailing and like getting into the stuff that you don't ever get a chance to clean. So
yeah, the clean.
It feels so good. Yeah,
it does. My job in our household is I'm the guy who cleans the cleaning stuff. Yeah. And more often than not, it's me, my wife being like, the vacuum, like with the Tyneco vacuum, you know, that thing. She's like, this thing sucks. Like not in a good way.
You don't like it? Oh, no.
Well, I like took it apart and I was like, it's because it, like literally no air is getting through. The thing is full of dust. Like the whole vacuum head was jammed full of like random stuff that we sucked up from the kids. And so like every couple months I have to go and we have the Roomba, the Tyneco, and like a proper plug-in Dyson. And I have to just do the whole like clean, change the filters, all that stuff. So that was my weekend.
So our Tyneco, whatever you call that, has an attachment that cleans the filter. So it looks like one of the, So I bopped that thing on there and I clean the filter before using it every time.
That's what I do too. Every now and then you can hear it. Like if somebody's using it and you can hear it, you can like know, okay. And like it comes with two filters, which is awesome. So you can just constantly have a good one. But then there's also like, there's like a HEPA filter in it as well, which is the air coming in. That thing needs to be cleaned. And then like the basket, it's a lot of work. That's one thing with the Dyson that we didn't have to do that often is to like stop and clean it. Because it's like, it's plugged in. The motor will just work harder to get past it. Whereas the battery one is very sensitive to that. Otherwise, the battery will just drain so quickly if you don't have that thing clean.
We had the battery Dyson before, and we had to clean ours somewhat regularly. But the cleaning process for the filters was that you had to wash the filter. And then you had to wash the filter and then wait for it to dry. And then
like 24 like by hours, the time
it dries, you're like, all right, I'm whatever I wanted to clean. You know,
I'm almost at a point where I want to just buy two of those Dyson filters just because you're kind of... But then our new house has CentriVac, which is like... So like we're in this spot where we're just like, the Tyneco is good for little stuff and the CentriVac is good for that. And the Dyson is very portable but heavy. And and then the Roomba stripped gears yesterday. So here I am trying to find a gear for it. Never ending. Anyways, vacuums. Vacuum talk. Let's talk about responsive design.
Yeah. Let's talk about responsive design. So I broke this episode, the show notes up into almost like a sandwich menu. We got the basic, the classic, the flex box, the clamp, the testing, spicy. The future, the spicy, all that stuff here. We got all these different types of grid and responsive design techniques. So this is going to be a fun one because, you know, really when we think about responsive design, I know a lot of people for a long time have just said, you know, it's breakpoints. We either do it mobile first and we do it this way, we do it that way. And that's the technique we've learned and we've done. But there's a lot of options out there. So I felt like it was a good idea to talk about maybe some of the different options you have available to you at different use cases, some of the pros and cons, maybe what the modern versions of all this stuff is, and then maybe some future stuff and even some testing stuff as well. So let's get into it. The very first thing is the basic responsive technique that exists. Some people might think it would be media queries, but in reality, the most basic level of technique you can have to have a responsive website, and for those of you who don't know the words responsive web design, a responsive website is a website that responds to its container or its viewport. So that way, when you use it on a mobile device or a tablet or even a watch, whatever, the website is going to shrink to the size in which the user is trying to access it rather than... was the older technique that used to be called adaptive design? Oh, no, what was the one where you had a mobile app?
Yeah. There was like a name for that. It was just called this M dot, where you just had two websites, a mobile website and a desktop website. And that was pretty popular early on. And in fact, you still see some websites that are M dot versions, but it mostly has moved over to responsive because it's much easier just to build one website and have it sort of adjust and snap. And as the browsers in mobile have gotten way better and data packages have gotten way better, it's not as necessary anymore.
Yeah, you almost never see the straight up mobile website anymore as its own thing.
Yeah, YouTube has one for whatever
they
reason.
They do. Did you just see that tweet? Is that why you said that?
No. What?
There's a tweet like last week or 2 weeks ago where somebody was trying to dunk on Google saying, Google has all these like big proclamations about using the web and web components and whatever. Meanwhile, their YouTube mobile experience gets like a 2% on all of the Lighthouse scores. And they responded to it that saying, well, that's actually not our mobile site. Our mobile site is a completely mobile site. You're not testing our mobile site. You're testing our website shrunk down. So yeah. That's how I learned about it somewhat recently. I didn't even think about that. Okay, so the basic version of responsive web design, back on track here. The basic version is fluid containers, giving things percentages instead of pixel values. You know, when you think about the web, a lot of times you think about you've been given a design. It's typically been given to you in pixels. And sometimes you have to translate those pixels into percentages. Instead of this thing being 900 pixels wide, this thing is, 60% of the viewport wide at any given point, or 90% of the viewport. And this is good for dynamic content where pixel perfect sizing is an important thing. Things can adjust, especially in between breakpoints. Now, we'll talk about breakpoints and media queries in a second, but it's important to know that like sometimes fluid containers and fluid elements are appropriate and sometimes they aren't, right? Like sometimes things are meant to be a certain pixel value, and at a breakpoint or at a time of change or a browser point, they move and they shift size to a dramatically different size rather than staying fluid within the container. So you don't always have to make divs and content fluid in between your breakpoints or anything like that, but a fluid container or a fluid width the size of a container is a responsive web design technique.
Totally. And one, probably the best property for all of us is using max width, especially on whatever your wrapper is. I can't tell you the amount of times that I've been to a website that is intended to be either mobile only or assumes that you, like somebody built it on a 15-inch SyncMaster from 20 years ago, and then you open it up on your massive 4K monitor and the thing is unreadable because it's so big. Pop a max width on there and that will say like max 1500 pixels. That's good. And that will stop it from going any larger than it should be, because a lot of people are always just thinking about what happens when this fluid container is shrunk down.
Yeah, I love max width. As specifically, I don't deal too much in the opposite where you're using max height and there are, or min height or those types of things. I do use that occasionally, but in terms of responsive websites, max width is such a good value to always have, because at the end of the day, there is a max width of something. your site, unless you very specifically have tested it on all those super giant wide browser or, browser widths, you probably want to throw a max width on that thing. So that's the basics, right? You have a container that expands to the browser width and that can change its size based on that rather than having something that is pixel-based. The next level here in terms of getting into responsive design techniques would be the classic media query. The media query, defined by the @media, is basically a wrapper around some CSS code that will toggle the CSS code on and off based on the essentially the arguments within that media query. So you could say if the browser width currently is greater than 100 pixels, then the background is red. And therefore, when the browser width is greater than 100 pixels, which it's always going to be pretty much, it's going to be background of red. And this is a responsive technique where it's responsive based on the viewport, which is important because, you know, these things are changing. For a long time, most of our browser techniques for responsive design have been based specifically on the viewport. And we'll see now with some other techniques that we talk about, there's kind of like this or that or this or that or this or that, whether it's viewport-based or component-based, container-based. So this one is based on the viewport. And typically the way people approach a media query is via several ways. They do it a desktop-first approach where you define all of your styles for the desktop viewport experience.
Yeah.
Then you use media queries to override and change things and make them smaller and appropriate for mobile. Now, there's also mobile first, which became hugely popular after the book Mobile First came out. And Mobile First made an argument to say, hey, you know, everyone's using your sites on mobile. Maybe you should just do mobile first. And that way you just increase the size of things as it goes up and you can add on layering for grids and stuff like that. There's also the just make it look good where you're kind of designing for the, you know, the middle of the road experience and then using breakpoints to, you know, augment the upper down.
Go up or down. Yeah, that's true. Because you think about us with our huge monitors, not everybody has a monitor that big, but you start to think, okay, well, what if somebody has 2,500 pixels to view this website? Does it make sense to take advantage of some of that or does it not? You know, so you could design for, I don't know, what, 1,600, 1,500 pixels as middle of the road. And then you pop a few media queries to go up and down from there to sort of make the site work well on both experiences. It's kind of interesting. Look, I heard someone the other day was describing desktop first, which is you code the desktop website and then go down to mobile as like the wrong way to do it. I think there was a couple of years there where people were like really anti- or maybe I will say pro mobile first. So I'm curious what's your approach when you're doing something like this, if it's not some of the other stuff?
Yeah, honestly, my approach has to do more about like the audience and the content of the site.
Yeah.
For me, specifically with level up tutorials, we get the majority of people utilizing our website in any meaningful way is on desktop. So our desktop experience for me is the most important. And because it's the most important, it is what I am developing for, and then I'm overriding to reach our mobile targets. And, you know, sometimes what I'll do, even if something makes more sense to be like less code to be mobile first, if I notice that while I'm coming back at it, I will like rework my CSS to be a little bit more mobile first. But yeah. I tend to take a little bit less of a really hard approach there. And more or less take this middle of the road, just make it look good approach where I'm developing for the screen sizes that our audience primarily hits our site at. And then everything else I am taking as overrides, essentially.
Yeah, I agree. I'm pretty much the same way. If I think, okay, well, the mobile version of this is just going to be simple. You know, like if it's just going to be one column and a little bit of padding and some text and a couple images, then maybe I'll go up. But for most of the stuff I do desktop first. And then most of my mobile dev is simply just sliding down, getting skinnier and skinnier and simplifying, making sure things are not too confusing on the mobile and a nice viewing experience.
Yeah. Totally. And I think this is one of those things where I think if you're part of a bigger team with a bigger project, lots of people using this, setting a, this is how we do it and only do it like that way. Like, I'm sorry, I had to sing that. I'm sorry, y'all.
I'm into it. Don't apologize. Yeah.
That's my song, by the way, at weddings. If you want me to start breakdancing. Courtney knows this.
This is how we do it.
This is how we do it. And for no specific reason, I love the Montel Jordan beat. I, you know, for me, that like Slick Rick song that it's based off is one of my favorite songs. But yeah. People will always come up to Courtney at weddings and be like, how do we get Scott to start dancing? And she'll say, we have to start playing This Is How We Do It. And then I know that that's a cue that, somebody asked her how to get me to start breakdancing. And then like they kind of naturally,
That's very amazing.
It's happened like 20 times.
I can't say that anyone has ever asked me to start dancing or singing at a wedding, but Party and, Chris, you'll have to bleep this out, Party and Bull from Notorious B.I.G. is my jam at weddings.
I would go nuts if I ever heard that song at a wedding. Yeah. Okay.
I'm pretty sure we played it at my wedding. We played Break Your Neck. Break Your Neck by Busta Rhymes was the when my wife threw the bouquet to all of her bridesmaids.
Oh my god.
It was Break Your Freaking Neck. Yeah, we had to find not the square version. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Freaking Busta. Yeah,
Busta is great.
Busta Rhymes' real name is Trevor.
Yeah, I knew that. He also voiced Reptar on
Wow.
That kid show.
That's a good one. Hold on. One more rapper thing. I just listened to a really good podcast with Theo Von, and he had Bubba Sparks on. Kind of interesting life story from him. I go check that one out. That's
Sparks.
Bubba Sparks. You remember Bubba Sparks?
I'll take you back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so back to responsive.
Breakpoints. Yeah. So another big strategy for breakpoints is to start mobile first or desktop first or wide first or whatever, and just slowly shrink or grow your viewport until things start looking bad. So sometimes people will use device breakpoints, right? And device breakpoints are commonly used devices. They'll download a list of devices and say latest iPhone, whatever. But the devices change so oftentimes, and there's so many different devices, device widths, device sizes. To me, this one makes less sense. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick personally 5 or 6 values where things start to look bad. And I'm just going to say, all right, this is the value. I'm taking, again, a bit of a hybrid approach between either device-based breakpoints or when things start looking bad. And I'm going to say, all right, here's the average points in which things start looking bad. And I'm going to list out maybe like 6 of those, and those will be my breakpoints for the site. However, some people just do it willy-nilly, and they'll just resize the thing and say, all right, we're at 1146 pixels. Now that media breakpoint, 1146, whatever the exact value I see when it's going to start looking bad. Yeah. I have a weird thing with like round-based numbers and things that are a little bit more, all right, I'll round it up to 12 here and just deal with it. So you certainly have a lot of options there, whether you are breaking at specific device points or if you're breaking when it looks bad or if you're breaking at, you know, predetermined sizes in which you've determined that. Yeah.
I'm kind of like you and kind of in the middle, because in the past I've just, whatever, it looks good at that point. But I've hit situations maybe once or twice in my career where there was like a 10 pixel like no man's land where something looked really weird. And there's a possibility by just throwing willy-nilly numbers in there, there's a possibility that you're going to do something really weird and you're not going to catch it because you're just kind of like moving the browser around.
Slapping the base. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just slapping the browser and you're not going to catch that. But by having a set of predefined, I have like common ones, 1100 pixels, 800 pixels, 500. And then I'll try to get them all kind of generally within that. And that's also really nice because if you open up your dev tools, you can see all of the breakpoints that you have and you can click on them and then it will snap the browser to that specific size, which is really cool. Don't just go willy-nilly, but also don't just say like the iPhone is the only mobile device in the world and I'm only going to size it for these 6 different sizes on iPhone.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about testing for some of the stuff later on too. But mine are, what is my small? My small is 500. So that's small for me now, is 500. I don't even go to 3, whatever, or 4, anything.
No?
500 for me. Anything below 500 is the same for me.
I wonder, how do you figure that out? Let me, by just opening up the mobile?
No, I mean, I'm just telling you what my breakpoints are for the level up site build. So 500 for me is the lowest, 700, 900, and 1200. So I only have 4 breakpoints on our current code base for level up, 500, 700, 900, 1200. I picked those numbers because, hey, those are good numbers right there.
I'm now curious what mine are. Okay, let's hold on a sec. Let me find mine.
While you're looking at that, one thing I should say is that, like, again, some strategy here is, do I need my experience to look nice on every size device, or do I need it to look very specifically on every size or specific sizes?
Yes.
Devices, right? If you're saying I need my site to look like this on every mobile device, then what you need to do is find the widest mobile device view and say, this is the widest view for mobile devices. This is my small breakpoint or whatever. But for me personally, if you have a phone over a 500 pixel width, you're going to get the medium experience of the site, which is basically the vertical tablet experience of the site. And the vertical tablet experience of the site is very similar to the mobile version of the website, you know?
Totally. All right. I just did a quick search through my code base. My entire westboss.com probably only has 20, 25 MIDI queries, and that I stick those inside of their selectors. So that's not very much. We'll talk about that approach in a sec. My smallest one is 320, and that's because I have an Instagram widget that needs to size photos a little bit smaller, and that could be solved by container queries. And then after that, it's just 450 and lots of 550, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I know. I think the ones I end up using the most are obviously the 500, the small boundary, and the 1200, which is the large boundary. Like, those are the two areas. And then everything else I can get working well with grid and some other techniques that we'll talk about to get it to kind of, you know, get it to where it needs to be.
Sorry. One last thing I want to say about is menus. One thing that can be really tricky in responsive design is getting your menu to look like how you want it on desktop and on mobile. And if you have any sort of complex menu that has dropdowns and whatnot, in the past, I've written tons and tons of CSS just to make it work in both situations.
Dude,
And I think, like, one thing I should be said is, it's fine to have two menus on your website. Just hide one. That's all I have to say there.
No, you know what? It's funny because in the course of our redesign, I almost do this in every single website. Not every single site, but there are times. And like in the course of this redesign, I was like, I'm going back to one mobile nav. I'm going back to one nav. And then I'll figure it out. CSS, the overrides and all that. And very quickly, I was like, oh yeah, now I remember why I went with this approach in the first place. And I went right back to having two. In fact, I have a component in Svelte called mobile view and one called desktop view. And all it does is show and hide the contents at a specific breakpoint. That's it. I just have that there because, you know, sometimes it's easy to say, all right, I'll pop this in a mobile view and it'll display none at lower.
Yeah, totally. Good. I'm glad that we're on the same page as that, because I was certainly on the other page, which is don't duplicate content. That's the same thing as having a mobile website, but it's not. Right. It's not. It's okay.
And I almost only do it for the nav. Almost ever.
Totally. Yeah, I don't think that, like, I'm trying to think of anything else that I've done. Even video players, complex things like that, I don't duplicate any of that for mobile because it just works. It's just that when it needs to look totally different and act totally different. You got JavaScript event listeners on some of them on mobile, but not on desktop, and people are resizing it and just to see how it works. Pain in the butt. Just do two if you hit that.
Totally.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors, which is Linode. Linode is cloud computing and Linux servers. If you're making a responsive website, you got to host that thing somewhere. Where are you going to host it? You're going to throw it on Linode. They have support for literally everything. If you have a Node.js website and you want to host it on Linode, they do that. They've got images that you can simply just click, and before you know it, you got the latest Node up and running with all the other stuff that you needed. It's fantastic. So they are going to give you $100 in free credit for your next website that you need to host at linode.com/syntax. Thank you, Linode, for sponsoring.
Sick, 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 sick. All right, let's get into, okay, so we've covered a lot of the basic stuff, right? Let's get into the fun stuff. We're going to enter the fun zone. You're now entering the fun zone, okay, where we're going to be talking about fun stuff, new stuff, interesting things. Actually, before we enter the fun zone, we're going to head into the time machine. I'm sorry. We're going to step out of the fun zone. We're going to head into the time machine, and we're going to check out grid systems. Now, grid systems are a common way of aligning things to a mobile grid, essentially, that expands. This was a technique that was used very widely and still probably is used very widely, if I'm being honest. You might be out there listening to this while doing a grid system for your CSS. I have left this in the dust a long time ago. But grid systems are basically, you define columns, and these columns are defined with CSS, and the columns will then shrink to say, all right, now one column is actually six columns, and six is now four, and four is now one on mobile. So that way, all you do is you worry about pinning your things to specific columns, and then as the columns change and reshape, your content just kind of just falls into place where it should be. And this was a really super helpful technique. I remember there were some Drupal themes like Omega, or you have Bootstrap and Twitter Bootstrap when it was still Twitter Bootstrap. You would just drop something on the grid. You put everything on the grid. You expand it where it needs to be through classes. And then your entire responsive website is defined, because instead of taking individual elements and giving them functionality based on viewport width, you're essentially defining that functionality on the grid system itself, and you're attaching your items to a grid system. Now, you can still do a grid system. It's just probably less required nowadays with CSS grid, because we have more flexibility with less code, and then you don't need to have a big old grid system full of CSS that you may or may not be using at any given point.
Yeah, I think it only makes sense to do a grid system if you are building a news website that has literally, it's like a newspaper. Totally. There's literally so much content that needs to go on the website, and you need major flexibility because you want to, we have to post this news story. That should take up 80% of the width, you know, and you need to show how that handles all the way down to mobile. But I think with CSS grid, a lot of this grid system stuff is no longer necessary, as well as, like, I always found, like, the grid systems were rolled out before responsive design, and they are very rigid, whereas now with Flexbox and grid, you sort of just have to embrace the flex, as something I said in my Flexbox course, is just be okay with it being a little bit bigger and a little bit smaller on different breakpoints. It doesn't have to look exactly. And that's, a lot of designers initially didn't like that because they wanted it to look exactly like their comps, but you got to embrace the flex.
Yeah, that's the thing about the web. Comps are almost just merely a suggestion. You've got to have it look good at any given point. So the designers should be around for all of these steps of responsive web design. But like, you can't necessarily have it predetermined how this thing is going to look at every single device viewpoint that exists. It's just about having it be fully functional and fully used. So now, after grid systems, then came like CSS grid itself. And maybe we should talk, before we get into container queries, just talk about grid and Flexbox, like you mentioned. Yeah. Grid and Flexbox are techniques overall for responsive web design. They can handle how things wrap onto new columns, how things flow through the document, how they fill space. You can tell the contents of the children to fill the space or not fill the space. You can tell them to stretch or shrink or do whatever. But at the end of the day, being able to define how a container flexes or displays any sort of dynamic grid is responsive web design. I'll talk more about this with some grid-based techniques, because there are some fancy grid-based techniques. A lot of things in CSS to me have been made way easier, especially in the fluid department, just via using straight up grid and Flexbox.
Yeah, I stopped writing a lot of media queries once grid came out. Not because it's like, oh, I hate media queries. It's just like, you don't necessarily need them. Totally. With the repeat, auto fit, and auto fill, along with min max allows you to put the literally the minimum that you want a column to be and the maximum that you want a column to be. Same thing with, you can also use that with rows, which is top to bottom instead of left to right. And that just makes everything really, really nice and fluid. I still find myself having to do a couple media queries here and there just to redefine what my grid is. Mm-hmm. Once you hit this thing, it's looking a little squished. Go from auto fit over to two columns and then down to one column. And that's fine because your media queries are really beautifully put where you just say, all right, over these next three breakpoints, I simply am just going to redefine what the grid is and the content will just fall into place within those grid things. You can even use, what is it, named areas in CSS grid.
Oh, yeah.
You could just say like call one, call two, call three, and you could just redefine what those named areas are and the content that is in them will just snap to those areas or vice versa. You can just say, all right, at this breakpoint, this content needs to go into the footer rather than from the sidebar.
Yeah. You know what? It's so funny because I do feel like at the end of the day, I am scratching the surface with all of the techniques available to us in grid. I see some major grid wizards out there doing some insane things. And sometimes I wish my brain worked that way. And sometimes it is a little bit easier for me, like you mentioned, just to say, all right, at this breakpoint, adjust the grid. At this breakpoint, adjust the grid. I know that there's more dynamic ways to do it, and certainly we're talking about them right now, but
yeah.
I do find myself oftentimes just adjusting the grid at breakpoints because my mental model reads that a little bit better.
Totally.
But there is this technique, and I posted a code pen from Sarah Sweden. Is that how you say your last name, Wes?
You can go back to the episode that we had her on, and I butchered it, so now I know.
Yeah, well, that's the only reason I'm at least a little bit on it here. I had a code pen from her and then a CSS Tricks post about autofill versus autofit because, you know, these are really good resources. But this is one of those things that you really want to see in action when you're using repeat with autofit and min-max. It looks like you're nesting multiple functions, right? But the way this actually works is that if you have grid template column set and you repeat how many columns you have, you're going to say autofit. And autofit fits the columns into the space by expanding them to take up the available space, right? So you're going to say, hey, take up the available space and fit into this container. Then you're going to say, but the individual column itself should be between a min-max value. You can give it a minimum value to say, maybe this thing's the smallest this thing can be is 100 pixels, and the largest it can be is one fraction. And one fraction is a dynamic spacing amount, right? And then that way you can build these grids that are actually changing dynamically as you're expanding and contracting them. And this type of skill right here, I think, is one that you'll need quite a bit of an experience with to really nail down, because it looks super complex and kind of obnoxious at first, but I think there's a lot there in terms of being able to get a lot of power out of CSS grid in that way. Mm-hmm. And likewise, there's also clamp, which is not a grid technique, but clamp is kind of like min-max, where with min-max, you give it a max and a min value, and it just makes sure it's within those bounds, right? Where with clamp, you give it a minimum value, a maximum value, and then like a value you'd like it to be. I'd like this to be this value. And many times
ideally,
people end up ideally, yeah. Many times people use like a viewport unit here. I'm going to give this 50 viewport units or whatever, and then or percentage. And then what you can have is a dynamic value that has an upper and a lower bounds, and then a middle ground that is constantly changing. And people often mistake this as being like a technique for fluid text, and it can be used for fluid text, but it's fluid text based on the viewport, not necessarily based on its container. So I have some links for clamp as well. And that's probably good for this side of things before we get into container queries.
Yeah, I got a couple more things to say. So Flexbox has a similar thing with that as well, is the flex value is ideally, and then you have flex grow and flex shrink. And those are proportional units of, given its siblings in line, how much bigger should this grow in proportion to the other one? So kind of like flex clamp, doesn't totally overlap the same use case in there as well.
I find flex grow and flex shrink to be the bane of people's existence.
Yeah,
it's
a tricky one.
Both of them are set to like grow and shrink so that your images can get all blown out of proportion in sort of weird ways inside of a flex box. Yeah.
Yeah. Once you start mixing them with aspect ratios and whatnot, it becomes a pain. I'm going to shamelessly plug my CSSGrid.io and Flexbox.io courses because they are free. And you will, like, honestly, if you want to be a good developer, get to know both of those things because you will be writing a whole lot less meaty queries if you're good with Flexbox and Grid.
Word. Cool. Well, let's actually take a quick second to talk about LogRocket, which if you're experimenting with some experimental CSS, perhaps you maybe messed up some of the values or some of the things and you actually had some syntax errors in your site causing things to break. Well, how would you know about this? Well, you could use a session replay service like LogRocket to surface some of those errors or maybe see that things are not quite lining up the way you would expect them. Perhaps a user is using your site on the desktop and they cannot click the thing because your responsive web design has gotten in the way and you're hiding that thing or blocking that thing, or maybe you didn't turn that thing back on and you didn't know it. But you can see that with the session replay because LogRocket gives you the ability to understand how your users are using your site and allow you to surface issues when there are some, but also identify UX and UI issues, just really enable your site to convert better. So if you want to try that and more, an awesome session replay service, head on over to logrocket.com/syntax. Sign up today and get 14 days for free. Thank you, LogRocket. Next is this is something that we've been waiting for so long. I cannot possibly express to you how much I want container queries to be the thing in my life right now. Next up is container queries. Container queries, very similar to element queries, were able to change CSS properties, only this time, instead of it being based on the viewport width, we're being able to change it based on the container size itself. Now, this is so big because nowadays we define things in components. How many times have you had a newsletter component, right? I would love to drop that newsletter component in my sidebar or in the main content area or anywhere and just have it adapt.
Pop up. Yeah.
Modal, literally anywhere. I would love for it to adapt perfectly to how I'm using it. And that's what container queries are for. Or here's another one, right? We have cards to define our courses. Those cards, they don't change their properties based on the viewport dimensions, because sometimes I'm adding a sidebar in here, sometimes I'm pushing things over. I don't want those cards to change. I want the cards to change based on their own size. So I actually use JavaScript for it right now. But this is the whole purpose of container queries, is to be able to define your CSS overrides based on the things containered. And luckily for us, CSS container queries are here everywhere except for Firefox, which, like Firefox, has been kind of the slowpoke in a number of things lately that I'm feeling a little raw about, because like there's so many things nowadays I pop open, can I use, and Firefox is the lone culprit. Like, what is this crazy world?
Yeah, I can't wait for container queries to be everywhere. Like, when, actually, it's a good question. Like, when do we expect them to come into Firefox? Because with all these things, once they hit all the browsers, you give it 6 months for everybody to update their browser and you're good to go. You know, like, I guess not in every single use case, but in a lot of use cases it is. And this is going to be really exciting that you can size things based on their container. One thing I am wondering is, what does it look like for the overall website layout? Are you still going to use grid or media queries to lay things out? I want my header to go here. I want my content to go here, my sidebar to go here, and a newsletter sign up down here, and then my footer down here. Like, that overall kind of page layout, how is that going to be done? Probably with grid, you think?
You know what? I would imagine that you would use grid or just normal media queries like normal. But, you know, there's really, I honestly don't know if there's any performance implications of container queries, but I don't see why that couldn't be done with container queries as well. There's, you know, for instance, we have layouts, and sometimes I want to use a layout inside of a layout, and that is a perfect opportunity to say, you know what, this layout should actually be a container query because now it's being used inside of another layout. We have these nested layouts or whatever.
Yeah.
And well, now it's not based on the viewport anymore. It's based on the container size. So I would imagine I am personally going to continue to use just straight up media queries to handle big layout things and then container queries for everything else, because it just seems to me like my mental model is there. And then I would suppose use Grid to do just grid based stuff where you can, where you don't have to do a container query, because, you know, media queries and container queries, they do add a bit of complexity to your authoring experience of your site overall. Let's talk about the syntax for container queries. So for container queries to work, you need a container, obviously, and then you need to define the container type. There are three different type of values for container type. It can be a size container type of size, which means that it's using the block and inline axes to give you your overrides for layout style and style containment to an element. So basically, if you need something to respond to both block and inline dimensions, which is either, you know, vertical and horizontal respectively, then size is the thing you're looking for. Otherwise, there's another one called a container type inline size, which I would imagine many of you out there, this is the one you're going to be using primarily, because this is for when the container is in the inline size. Think primarily width, right? Your container width is growing, you're going to use container type inline size. And then there's the third property, which honestly, I don't understand the naming here, is just normal. Inline container type normal, which means it's not a container. It's not a container query or a query container. So why wouldn't they just call that like none? I don't know. Container type none? That seems to make more sense to me, but maybe there's a good reason for that.
I just went out and bought containerqueries.io. I was so happy. I usually try to, when I have like a kind of a naming convention, Flexbox.io, CSS Grid.io, and then the one is not available, that always makes me mad. So I was like, oh, I totally forgot about that. But luckily, no one has nabbed it yet.
Yeah, that's nice. I never buy too many domains for my courses because I just have them under one roof. But
I have so many silly ones.
Okay, so you defined your container itself with container type. Then the content itself within the container can then be used like a normal media query. The only thing is instead of saying at media, you're saying at container. And then you'd say at container mid width 700, whatever. If this container, that min width is 700, does that mean that this is my dyslexia brain. If it's min width 700, it means that the width must be 700, and then the container query will take effect.
At a minimum of 700. So that meaning that 701 pixels and above, or is it inclusive of 700? I think it is.
I don't know.
Min width of 700. So 700 and above is going to be applied. So this would be a mobile first container query, I guess.
And people out there who might be wondering why I'm struggling with such a basic concept, I actually use one of these future things primarily. It's called like ranged media queries, and it greatly improves the syntax to how my brain understands it, because min width and whatever, that syntax is literally something from day one, from, you know, my first day on the job, is something I've had to look up, because I don't know why my brain just swaps it every time I think about it. So either way, you define it as at container and then a normal container query type of ranged value, and then you can make your modifications in there. So container queries, it's really a two-step process. You just define something as being a container for container queries, and then you define the actual overrides you need to do. You can also name your container queries. So if you want to have multiple containers with different, multiple contained containers, you can give one of them a name. And then when you use your at container, instead of having to be like, oh, just use the nearest one, you give it a name. So that way it knows which one to look at. That way you're not stepping on the toes of your own containers. When I first saw that you had options for naming containers, I was thinking, this seems a little weird. But in practice, it totally makes sense, especially if you have nested containers there. And also, in addition, there's new container units coming. Container query width, container query height, CQI, I don't know what CQI is. CQ min, CQ max, CQB. Oh, inline and block. Container query inline, container query block.
Oh, that goes back to the logical properties thing, which is it's width and height, but harder to understand.
Yes, you nailed it. Yes, perfect. So all of this said, we love container queries. We stand container queries over here. Firefox is still missing. You know, I looked up the container queries on Bugzilla for Firefox, And I have a hard time really like knowing how this thing's progressed. I mean, the last issue on this thing was 8 hours ago, 11 days ago. So they're working on it. But there is a comment from somebody says, for what it's worth, somebody 20 days ago left a comment on this thing. For what it's worth, Chromium, Safari, all have full support. Basically just being like, foot tap over here, like
and,
Firefox.
And the spec is done, on? Right? Like it's approved, it's final.
Yeah, I think it's stage three.
Okay. So I'm just reading container queries on MDN, and it says the example syntax should be used in explainer to evolving specification. Last updated on 15 September 2021, adds details. So that was over a year ago. They updated this, and they say as the spec continues to evolve, they will update it. So who knows? Like Firefox had like a mass, or Mozilla in general had a massive layoff, like I don't know, about a year ago, or they half their employees got laid off. And I wonder if they're just waiting for it to be done before they implement it.
It seems like they are implementing it right now based on this Bugzilla thing, but like,
yeah,
man, it's really starting to feel like Firefox is taking a long time.
Firefox
here.
Is a new Safari.
Oh man, look at you with that hot take. I know. All right, we got to get moving here. We got some more things. Next one is going to be Fit Text, which is a long used way to essentially have your text fit a container dynamically, have it resize itself. Now, this is not possible without JavaScript. There's been a number of Fit Text jQuery plugins over the years and different things that have worked really well. When I personally went to implement a Fit Text solution for Level Up, I was really upset at there not being like anything super modern, effortless, easy that just worked all the time. So I had to write my own. And when I started writing my own, which seems like it's no fun, it actually is unbelievably simple. In fact, my implementation of this thing is like 40 lines of code. So here is what a Fit Text JavaScript-based solution does. You have a container with an overflow of hidden. That container is inline block and has some size properties on it. So you have a container that has a kind of defined size. The way ours works is it is a child of a grid, and that's where it gets. So it's inline block within a grid child or grid, whatever. And so you have overflow hidden on that container. And what you do is you give your text a starting size, and using JavaScript, you do a loop and you say plus one to this size pixel. And then you check to see if the text overflows in either dimension. Does it overflow in the X or the Y? If it does, then you subtract one from the size and then set that to be the size. So it's like you increase the font size to the point in which it overflows the container. The moment it does, you back it up one. In fact, the way that we do it, because I wanted it to be a little bit more performant, I wanted to use this thing a whole bunch. I end up saying the step for ours is more like 3 or 4 pixels. So I'm bumping the font size up 3 or 4 pixels each loop and then dialing it back 3 or 4 pixels each time. That way I can have it do without, you know, it's a little bit less accurate, right? But yeah. I'm using a lot of them, so I don't want a ton of JavaScript going crazy here. So believe it or not, that's how you do it. It's really simple. You just increase the font size until it overflows, and then when it does, you back it off. That's it. I made a svelte action.
I love that.
For this.
Yeah, I love that. I wish that there was something in CSS for that. You can kind of hack it with Clamp, but not really. You have to have like a fixed letter font. What's it called? A monospace font where every single letter is the exact same size and you need to measure it. And not great.
Theoretically, you could fix it with Clamp using container query units. So the container query width. Because the big thing about this not working with Clamp is that it's based on the viewport, right? So if you could base it on the container query width, hey, that might be a suitable solution there. So maybe I'll hack together something and see if I can get a better solution. Because this JavaScript solution works, but it stinks, you know?
Yeah, I tried getting it working with Content Editable a while back. Mm. And I was hitting all kinds of issues. It was with that. I talked about how I made that label maker for when we were moved.
Yeah.
And I ended up just putting on click of a button to fix it. But yeah, I forget the issue, but I love it. Fit Text is so cool.
Yeah. Okay. Next up is testing this kind of stuff. How do you test these types of things? Well, your browser has a baked in device viewports. If you do inspect and you have your typical viewport, there's a little mobile device it's called the device toolbar. you can toggle that device with on the Chrome version with Command Shift M, and that's Command Shift M for mobile. That gives you the option to do dimensions of various responsive phone sizes for various devices, but I almost always just use the responsive one, and that gives you little dragging toolbars so you can click and drag and make this thing correctly sized. But this is, again, this is, it's important to state that this is just your normal browser resizing the viewport. This is not viewing this thing on an actual mobile device. So if you're the type of person who is experiencing bugs on real mobile devices, then your two options are the Android emulator or the iOS simulator based on which browser you're having issues with, which device. For Safari or for iOS simulator, you can actually inspect the iOS simulator via Safari. Very easily. You just go to, like, I think it's like develop and then inspect, and it'll give you the option for that device for the simulator. So if you're having real issues on an iOS device, load it up in the simulator, which comes on every Mac. Next up is an app that I've been using to do all of my responsive design testing. They were a sponsor on an episode of Syntax. We're going to have the creator of this app on the show at some point, but Polypane is an app that lets you have a whole bunch of different canvases to test different browser sizes. It gives you a lot more tools than that. But, you know, it's a really handy tool to zoom out and see as many or as few browser widths as you want. And you could say, all right, just give me the full gamut. Give me 12 different devices here and let me zoom out and I can see high level if there's any issues. So that's a really nice thing as well for testing, to be able to see everything in one fell swoop. Lastly, the last thing I want to talk about in this episode before we move on to our sick picks is the future. Now, here's two really beautiful future techniques besides CSS media or container queries. Ranged media queries. I used ranged media queries myself. It allows you to say width is greater than 700 pixels instead of the whole that min width, max width stuff that drives my brain wild.
Yeah, that trying to convert that mentally, being like min width. And then if you have multiples, like you have a range of like, oh man, what a pain in the butt.
And this allows you to just say if width is between 200 and 700 pixels, do this. And it's the range stuff is so much easier for me to read. So I'm really thankful for that. Next is custom media queries, where you define a custom media query with @custom-media. You give it a name like a CSS variable. Then you pass in the value of what the media is. And then anytime you want to use that, you just say @media --. The name of the ours. It's like ours is above med for above medium. So we have above med, above small, below small, above large, below small, all that stuff, right? And that way I don't have to look up pixel values. I don't have to think about size numbers. I just know, all right, I'm having an issue here. We're in the medium context of the site. All right, above medium, do this. Below medium, do this, whatever. And that's great. So those are two awesome new future techniques. This is a whole lot of stuff to say, hey, you can get your website looking like however you possibly could want on any viewport. And a lot of techniques and a lot of stuff. So if you have any really neat CSS responsive design techniques that we didn't talk about in this episode, or things that we missed, or really interesting code pens that are doing some wild stuff, share it with us on Twitter and we'll give you a retweet, because CSS responsive design is, you know, one of the biggest parts of our job. And there's so many things here. There's just an endless amount of different options and techniques that you can do. And sometimes things get a little bit better. Sometimes they get more complex. But at the end of the day, we're always moving in the right direction here. So shout out to everyone working on browsers and making our lives easier in that regard. You know who else is making our lives easier, Wes?
FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the cloud accounting solution that you need for your small business, for your medium-sized business, any type of business, because billing and payments is a pain in the butt. It takes away from you actually working on stuff. Like when I have to spend any amount of time fussing with accounting and paperwork and all that stuff, I get frustrated because I want to be writing code. And FreshBooks takes that and makes it as fast as possible so I can get back to writing code. You're going to want to check it out. FreshBooks.com/syntax for a 30-day free trial. No credit card required. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sick. Sick picks. I have a sick pick for you today, Wes. I have been going absolutely ham on my smart lighting setup in my house because, you know what? Some new switches came out from Lutron, who's like really, Lutron, the Caseta switches before were very super nice. They don't require common wire. There's like a lot of reasons why the Lutron switches are very nice. However, I wasn't going to bite the bullet on outfitting my whole house until these new ones recently came out. There are these Diva dimmer switches. They have a little dimmer dial. And they're really nice switches. And they've recently come out with the smart version of them. And so I bought 8 of them and I've been putting up all over my house. And even some of the non-Diva ones, some normal Lutron switches, some normal Caseta switches. And I gotta say, these things totally rule. They connect really well. The installation process is nice and easy. You know, so many of these smart switches that you can find on Amazon or wherever, you have no idea what this garbage is. So you at least know it's a reputable brand. I'm not putting some junk electronics in my wall. And so far, I've installed 7 of 8 of them. And I've gotten really good at installing light switches, but I'm also, you know, feeling very confident with the switch themselves. They have these little night lights on the little dimmer. There's a lot of like really interesting features. And I got to say, quality for light switches here is just really super good. So Lutron Smart Diva switches. The Caseta ones are also great. And I think I have a Claro or something is the one that I use for the fan as well. But they all work great.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, fan. I learned the hard way that you can't just put a dimmer on a fan.
Nope.
Fan controllers are very different things.
Yeah. And so I just use a straight up normal switch, but it's like a smart Claro switch on off, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I am going to sick pick some light bulbs from a company called Sunco. So on the previous shows we've done smart home, I said, don't try to use like switches where possible, smart switches instead of smart bulbs. Yeah. Because the problem is that when someone hits a switch, then your smart bulbs are dead. But I recently, we moved into a new house and we have this like down lighting, which is like in the soffit of the house. The previous owners put these like super bright white, like cool white ones in there. And they're awful. So I was like, are we going to switch them out? And I was like, why don't I just put those like RGB bulbs in there so that when it comes time for Christmas, we can just make them Christmas color and it will look really, really nice. So I bought a bunch of these. They're from a company called Sunco. And they're like super cheap right now. I paid about $10 a bulb, but now they're on
other
sale.
Bulbs are so expensive.
Yeah. That's, I was looking at some of the like Philips ones and they were like 30, 40.
We have a
40.
Number of the Hue ones. Yeah, yeah. We have a number of those. Yeah.
They're so expensive. I went with these ones. They're Wi-Fi. You have to pair them all before you put them up. And then I bought this like stick. Like it's like a 20-foot stick that you can unscrew light bulbs from places that are too high because it's like 30 feet in the air. So I had to go on the ladder and unscrew it. And it's awesome. Their things are super reactive. The colors look great. I wouldn't recommend them for indoors. Because they're not bright enough for indoors. I've found this with LED strips. I found this with a couple different things is that the colored lights, unless they're 15 watts or something like that, they don't put off enough color to actually look decent inside. But for outside where it's dark, especially downlights, these things look awesome. So I got a bunch of the downlights and then a bunch of the regular ones for just like the garage light fixtures and whatnot as well. And they look great. I think the only thing, and this is not an issue, is that you have to tell the family not to turn off the light switch. so the solution there is you just hardwire them on. And then that's not a big issue because your family's not turning them on and off every day because they're on a timer, right? You just have them turn on at sunset. Yeah. Or 10 minutes before sunset, you have them turn on and then you have them turn off. A 10:30, whenever you go to bed. That's part of my like go to bed routine in Google Home. And they're awesome. So they're called Sunco. They work with the Tuya app. The Tuya stuff is not always the best of quality, but I've been fairly happy with all the Tuya stuff that I've got so far.
Yeah. Man, it's time to do another smart home app. I've been getting really into that. We have I have all my automations now are totally through Home Assistant. So I'm not doing any Google Home automations. And I have it every, like, now that I have so many light switches, I need more. I need maybe about like 6 more before it's like truly the promised land. But
yeah,
like now like I have our kids' lights are slowly getting dimmer from like bedtime to, you know, an hour past bedtime to encourage them to actually go to bed. And I have like a playlist that plays during dinner. So like our speakers at the like lower level will just start playing a specific music playlist, like our dinner music playlist. It's just awesome, man. There's so many fun things you can do with home automation.
I love it. The one I recently did was my kids, all their closets have switches. And so they turn it on to look for their clothes and they never turn it off. And it drives you crazy as a dad. So I just set one as when it turns on, wait 10 minutes and turn it off. And it's so beautifully simple, but like it just, and I did the math and it pays for itself in 5.5 years, the smart switch. So it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. All right, shameless plugs. I'm going to shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. We have the biggest sale ever going on right now. We have a new course on SvelteKit coming out that's going to be the place to learn SvelteKit. So if you want to get all of that amongst the hundreds of other courses and content on Level Up Tutorials, sign up for the year at the cheapest price. This thing is, this is the only time of the year you're going to get this. So this is the last chance to get this sale price for Level Up Tutorials and learn a ton about modern web. We have modern CSS design systems that teaches you how to use CSS variables. We have modern CSS layouts that teach you how to use CSS grid and CSS flexbox. And soon we're going to have a modern CSS responsive course to teach you all of that and more. Just nonstop stuff coming from leveluptutorials.com.
I'll shamelessly plug what I already shamelessly plugged. My CSS grid.io course and my flexbox.io course. Those are both free. I will also have big Black Friday sale on as well at westboss.com/courses. But grab a free one. CSS grid.io, flexbox.io, learn grid and flexbox. It's good for you.
It's good for you.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for listening. We will see you in the next one. Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.